This is an ATSF iProfessionals industry insight into managing interactive media.
I'm Matt Farrow, and I'm Head of Information and Knowledge Sharing at WWF UK. I think my top insight would be that at the beginning of a project, to be really clear about the scope and specification of what you're hoping to achieve, and to make sure that all the stakeholders involved understand the scope of the project and what it's going to deliver, and that this is agreed and signed off before you start work. And following that, I think it's also about managing changes to the scope as they occur throughout the project, because that always happens. You start a project, and even if you map it out as well as you possibly can, there will be things that haven't been thought of. But it's making sure they're managed in an appropriate way that doesn't involve having to go back to the drawing board and start again. You can never do too much work at the beginning of a project to actually think about what you want to achieve and make sure everyone understands that. For us, obviously coming from the charity sector, we have kind of two main strands of our work. One is providing information to people, members of the public, different audiences, things, sometimes information that they particularly want, or other times information we want them to have. And the other side of it is getting people to take action. And that action can be to change the way they live their lives, you know, things like making environmental impacts by such small things as changing to energy-saving light bulbs, or big things like buying an eco-friendly house or something like that. And there's also other ways they can support us, for instance, maybe doing some campaigning work for us, or even supporting us financially, becoming a member, adopting an animal, that kind of thing. So there's two strands of our work, really, is getting information out to people and getting people to do something for us and for the environment in general. What I think we are going to be looking at in the next few years is converging those two strands of our work. And there's a lot of exciting developments with online stuff, interactive TV, and particularly getting people involved in a long-term basis. We don't want people to just give us their money and forget about us. We want to engage people in a dialogue, and the web gives a perfect way of doing that, getting people to kind of converse with us on an ongoing basis. And we're only really just starting to do this, but to be able to have people create their own content and submit stuff to us and really to kind of engage in that sort of dialogue and thereby become better supporters for us and better advocates for our messages. At WWF, we launched a site called Chemical Voices. And what we're trying to do with that is to get people who feel that their health and well-being has been affected by toxic chemicals to actually tell their stories. And because we need that support, because at the moment, the issue of toxic chemicals affecting people's health and also the health of the environment as well, people are an indicator of that. There's still a lot of kind of controversy of what those effects have been and can we actually identify them. So getting people to tell their stories, to say, I worked with pesticides for 30 years and I'm now suffering from this form of cancer or whatever, it helps to lend support to this because the chemical industry will deny that there's any kind of connection. So the science is very much in its infancy at the moment. So we wanted to get people to engage with us and to tell us their stories and for those stories to be published online and then to engage them in a dialogue where these people could talk to each other and form a kind of community. That obviously had quite significant implications for us, because just allowing people to tell their stories means that there are lots of opportunities for them to say things that maybe aren't true, maybe are defamatory to organisations. We have to be very careful. WWF's a scientific organisation, and we like to make sure that we don't make any kind of claims that aren't backed up by science and that we can't substantiate. So we had a lot of kind of legal issues about the disclaimers we have to produce and how we can distance ourselves from some of the things that people might say, whilst at the same time not deterring people from telling their stories freely. In our education work, we have a site called wwflearning.org.uk, which is a site for teachers mainly, to help them get sustainable development into the national curriculum. We have done a lot of online debates for pupils and online discussions for teachers as well. And we do pre-registered student debates, so they all have to register first to avoid any possible issues with people going online and talking to children. But they've been very successful, and the kids will go on at a pre-arranged time and they will have a debate. And that's been really useful. And we've been doing those for quite some time, but only in the education sphere. But there's lots of other ideas about how we might use kind of community-based content and have a particular area of the website where people can log in and maybe create their own profile and then be able to talk to other people who are maybe members or other kinds of supporters. But as I said, it's very much in its infancy and WWF is looking at the options out there. We as a charity obviously can't afford to jump on every bandwagon that there is in terms of technology. We like to try and be as close as we can to the cutting edge, but we feel that we don't want to be the ones who are the guinea pigs because we've got very limited budgets. WWF has an in-house web team and we provide a lot of the kind of technical support that's necessary for development. There are some projects, however, that we do put out to external developers. For the larger projects, we would consider going out to a number of suppliers, but generally we tend to use the same one who provides our content management system and our hosting as well. We use a variety of different smaller suppliers for different things. So we might have freelance developers come in and do bits of work for us. We have database developers and we have different systems that we use. We have a bulk email system that we buy in from another supplier. So we do use a range of different providers, but we have a preferred suppliers list that we tend to use. Typically, someone will come to us and say, I've got a great idea for a web project that we should do. And we would sit down with them and say, well, okay, just talk us through what sort of thing you want, because a lot of the time people think of the same things. So different people in different departments will come up with a very similar idea. And we try as much as we can to kind of capitalize on that and to do things in a coordinated way so we don't end up having these different silos of development going on. So we'll initially sit down with them, try and get to the kind of the heart of what they want to do. And then one of the most important things that we do first is think about who else this could affect. Us being kind of central to the organisation, we do have an idea of where the different touch points are. So initially it's about identifying the stakeholders and the people who will be affected by the project. Once we've done that, we get them to fill in a briefing form and just to outline the objectives of the project, the scope, any potential risks, any timelines that we have to meet, measures of success, and what the actual deliverables will be. And then we like to have a kickoff meeting where we get as many of the stakeholders as is necessary together and talk about it. That's when you start to get different people's opinions and you start to find out why some of them might be affected and what some issues people might have. People are usually concerned about electronic projects that might have an impact on their job and all sorts of things like that. So we can kind of allay some fears and we can gather together all of the information about how this might affect people. Next thing we would normally do is put together a kind of project definition that would be based on what we've gathered from the kickoff meeting and what the initial brief said, and to draw up a proper kind of timeline for the project and to get that agreed. As I said earlier, that one of the most important things is making sure that people are aware of what the project is going to deliver and when and what their involvement is. And so it's really key to assign roles and responsibilities. What we really like to do is to make sure we book up meetings with people for specific tasks. So not just a catch-up meeting where you just kind of talk about it, but say, right, at this meeting we're going to sign off a sitemap or we're going to look through wireframes or whatever and agree those. And I think that's a good way of getting people to actually think about it. We have a real email culture at WWF, so you get bombarded by emails every day and there's only a certain amount of time to read them. And I often find that if you email something around, people will look at it in a cursory way and say, yep, I'm fine with that. And then it's only later that they realise that they maybe should have paid a little bit more attention to it because it has a significant impact on what they want to do. So we like to get people to actually sit down and look at something. And we find that it's really helpful to do a proper sitemap and get it signed off and do wireframes as well so that there's no surprises when it comes to the end product. And it's also about putting in a plan that's got the appropriate level of contingency in it as well, and to identify what risks there are and to try and understand them and mitigate them wherever possible. And then to make sure that you just keep regularly updating people throughout the project and that people are taken along with it. So that's basically how we would kick off a project. Stakeholders could be a challenge, particularly if they are more senior or if they're in a different division or department where there's no kind of line management responsibility there. I think the key to it is to make sure that they're involved as much as possible, and not just by email, but actually have meetings, talk to them face to face, and find out what it is that makes them tick. Because they're a stakeholder in a project for a reason. Sometimes it's because they want to be a stakeholder, because they're initiating the project, or because they stand to benefit from it. But also they can be affected by the project. We have a lot of projects which result in fulfillment having to be delivered to supporters. And we have a fulfillment team in-house who are absolutely vital to any project's success. And so it's really key that they're involved at the beginning, and we find out what they need, what's going to make their job easy. Because it's all very well to put up a website that looks great and gives the user a good experience, but if we then can't fulfill it properly, or if it causes us loads of problems internally, that's not good either. So those are the kind of stakeholders who are affected by a project, but might not be driving it themselves. So it's absolutely vital that their views are taken into account as well. So I think it's a question of looking at why someone is a stakeholder, what they hope to get from the project, and making sure they do get that as much as you can. We have a central web development budget, and we use that for doing the majority of our web development. There are some projects which we would manage that are funded from different budgets. We have an information system strategy group, which I sit on, which looks at not just web stuff, but any kind of information related systems development for the organisation in a strategic way, so that we're not doubling up on expenditure particularly. And some projects might be funded from that budget if it was a strategic project that happened to have a web dimension to it. So in that case, we would take the budget from there. But most of our development comes from a central web development budget. Having said that, a lot of our projects are developed in-house, and mostly by employees rather than subcontractors. So there isn't really any financial cost except in staff time, so we don't have to do any recharging or anything like that. But it is very difficult to work out costs with web projects. Where we do go out to tender for a project, we sometimes work on a time and materials basis with developers, and sometimes we work on a fixed cost for our development. The fixed cost approach is better in some respects, because obviously you know how much you're going to pay for it up front. However, it does involve a lot more work at the beginning to make sure that you've properly spec'd it out and there aren't going to be any nasty surprises later. And they do tend to come in slightly more expensive, because obviously the developer's got to cover their back, and if something's going to take 3 months rather than two, that's coming out of their pocket. One of the things that ends up costing a lot of money in web projects is bug fixing and testing at the end of a project. If a project is properly specified at the beginning and there's a test process put in place before it gets to that stage, you can save a lot of money by not having to go through various iterations of testing and fixing, and then having to re-specify and change the way this it's been developed. So I think it's absolutely vital, if you want to keep costs down, to ensure that the specification has been done properly at the beginning, and that there's a test plan in place and proper time is set aside for testing. And that's absolutely vital. For me, part of quality is making sure it does what it's supposed to do, and it doesn't break, and it doesn't give you any nasty surprises, which again comes back to specification and testing. If you want to make sure that what you deliver at the end of the day is what your stakeholders expect, you have to know what they want, and you have to make sure it does that. And there's no real substitute for doing the proper testing to making sure that it actually does that before you give it to the stakeholders and say, here it is. They shouldn't be finding bugs. They shouldn't get any nasty surprises. What they should get is the thing that you said you were going to deliver, which is a challenge, because often people don't know what they want, or they think they know what they want, but they're not really sure and they haven't thought it through. And that's always going to be the case. I think you can get around a lot of that by really talking to people and showing them diagrams and mock-ups and whatever, so that to try and tease out all the little thoughts they've had but haven't really articulated. But there will always be things that when they actually see the product, they think, oh, hang on, it wasn't supposed to work like that. I never really thought about it. So you can never do too much talking to people and trying to get out of them what it is they're hoping you're going to deliver. I'd say that the two main difficulties that I've picked up on when I've been working on web projects is, firstly, scope creep, and second, unclear roles and responsibilities. Scope creep is when the scope of a project just changes kind of, it can be gradually throughout the project, or it can be quite drastically in the middle of a project. And I think that is a real nightmare, particularly if you're at a later stage of development. And again, I would say the way to avoid that is to make sure that everyone is properly consulted at the beginning and that the specification is clear. It can be quite a challenge to do that, given the limited timeframes projects often have. And it's sometimes felt that you should be moving straight into actually developing it and building the finished product. But a little bit of time spent at the start can avoid that kind of scope creep, because people know what's expected of the project and they've had their opportunity to say it. There will always be changes to scope, because you can't think of everything to begin with, but it's how you manage that and what kind of changes you allow and what the knock-on effect of those changes is, and managing the expectations. And some deadlines can't be missed. That there may be an external event or something which dictates that it has to be done that day, in which case there's got to be a compromise, and that's got to be managed, and that is a challenge. The other difficulty is unclear roles and responsibilities. Typically in WWF, there'll be a large number of people involved in any project, because it can touch on all the different parts of the organisation. And it's really important that you know at the beginning of a project who's going to do what, and who makes decisions, and who gets to sign off on things. Because it can be a case of design by committee if you're not careful. And also, you've got to be clear that this person knows about that area, they're the specialist. So when you want to know about that area, talk to them. Don't talk to this person who thinks they know about that area, but will actually not take into account all the things that are important. And that's happened on a number of occasions where we've thought someone had the authority and the knowledge to say, yep, that's the way we're going to do it. But in fact, it was someone else completely. So I think it's really important to be clear about who's doing what they're responsible for, and what they can sign off on. At the end of the day, the users of a product are the most important people. And users can be both internal and external as well. In terms of our external users, the public or whatever audience we're hoping to address with the project, there are various different ways of kind of finding out what they want of a project and what their expectations are. For some audiences, if they're a very specific audience, it's actually possible to go and talk to them. And this might be the case if we were working on something to do with the press or maybe government, something like that. We have a relationship with these people. We can talk to them, we can find out what they want, we can find out their preferred way of accessing information and what they hope we're going to deliver for them. And that's a real advantage, because then there's no kind of guesswork going on. With other audiences who are more diverse and less easy to define, it's more challenging. There's various ways we can find out more about what they want. We've used user surveys in the past on our website. We've done small focus groups. We've looked at stats as well. We can see where people are going on our site, and we can kind of make extrapolations of what they would be looking at and where the problems are with our site. Those are the main kind of tools we've got. Accessibility is one of my key areas of work. We've done a lot of work in the last year or so on making our site more accessible to our users. And that's not necessarily users with disabilities or impairments of any kind. It can be just accessible to any users, depending on what systems they're using to access the site. So we try to ensure that our sites comply with the latest guidelines for accessibility, and we do lots of testing in-house. We want to do more usability testing externally as well, but that's obviously quite costly, so we have to justify that. But I think that's really important. It can reveal things about your site that you never would have picked up on yourself. And we've done some in the past and it's been really useful, been an eye-opener. So accessibility is very important to us. We're looking at complying with as high a standard as we possibly can without compromising what we're actually trying to achieve. We redesigned our site about a year ago. We were aiming for AA compatibility because AAA is very, very hard. It would be something that would have to be externally validated as to whether we've met that. We try really hard to make sure everything's accessible. We try never to use images as text and things like that. We try to make sure we've always got useful alt text on things, and that we've got access keys, and that the site, if there's no style sheets turned on, that it still works properly and can be used on different browsers and different platforms. Our directors have recently all been given BlackBerrys, and it's quite interesting seeing the site on those. So yeah, we strive to be as good as we possibly can. The level of testing required depends on the kind of product we're creating. Some of the sites we build are information sites, so there's not a lot of functionality in them. And in that case, it's more making sure that all the content is properly edited before it goes online, and then making sure all the links work and things like that. It's fairly straightforward. However, a lot of the projects we work on are quite technical. We have our system for integrating our website with our database, and often we'll be doing a new project which involves a different type of data being submitted through the interface. Whenever we do that, we have to modify all the procedures that are involved, and then we have to test all of the different transaction types we have to make sure that there hasn't been a knock-on effect by introducing a new piece of functionality to them, because things can slip through quite easily. It's very easy to leave out a comma or a quotation mark or something in a bit of script that can have profound effects that you wouldn't notice straight away. And it's good to notice those before they go live, rather than having to go back retrospectively and fix them, which can just be an absolute nightmare and sometimes impossible if you've lost data. We always do a kind of unit testing before we go live with something. So we'll test within the team and make sure everything's working. And then we try to do testing with users throughout the organization as well. If it's a big project we're launching, we try to get people involved who maybe don't use the web that much or don't know about the project we're working on. The main legal things we have to bear in mind at WWF are, firstly, copyright. All of our text tends to be copyright WWF. That's fine. Where we could come unstuck if we didn't pay close attention to it is images and other forms of media as well. We have a lot of our own images because we have a photo library here, but we also use images from other sources. And you have to be very, very careful that images you're using are actually allowed to be used on the web. Sometimes we could buy an image for use in a print material and then find that we haven't got the rights to use it on the web, and doing so could actually involve us in costly legal cases. So we're really, really strict on what we use online, making sure we own those assets and that we can use them on the web. And the same is true of video and audio as well. And so just being really, really careful that we can use them. Other things to do with images and video is to do model release. You have to make sure that people are happy to have their video or pictures online. We're very strict with our use of our logo online as well, and the use of other people's logos with our logo, because we have to make sure that we're not seen as endorsing products or organisations that we don't endorse. So we're very careful about what we will allow to appear on our site and how other people use our logos as well. Another area that we're just getting into and I alluded to earlier is contributions to the site from the public or from other audiences. We don't do much of it at the moment, but what we do, it has to be very carefully vetted, and we have to put in place all the terms and conditions that in some way kind of indemnify us against defamation and that kind of areas. So we're only just getting into that, but we're going to have to be very strict on that because it could affect our position as an impartial scientific organisation. So those are the main areas that we pay attention to in terms of legal issues. I think working with interactive teams can be quite a challenge, but it's a challenge I really enjoy. And I think the best way of getting the best out of people is to give them the scope to exercise their skills in their particular areas. And I'm very participative in my management style. I like to get people discussing things, and I like to make sure everyone has their say. It can mean things take a little bit longer to do, but what it means also is that people buy into something they're working in. If people don't feel that they have a say and they don't feel that they're kind of empowered to make a difference in a project, they feel a lot less inclined to give it their all. So I like people to have the opportunity to say what they think, to discuss it, to challenge as well. I think that's very important. I know that I'm not infallible, and I always feel most suspicious about projects when no one challenges me. I always think, well, I doubt I've got this right first time. Why isn't anyone saying to me, is this the right way to do it? So I do value that kind of challenging atmosphere, and I try to foster it wherever possible. I think a occasionally there are times when you have to say, I know this isn't the best way of doing it, but we've got a deadline to meet and we have to do it. And I think creating the atmosphere where people feel that most of the time they have the ability to express themselves and to put their views across means that when you do have to say, no, this is just the way it's happening, they'll respect that because they know this, okay, this is why it's having to be like that. And I think explaining why as well, not just saying, well, I'm the one who says what goes and that's what's going to go. I think that doesn't work. I think you have to say to people, well, it's got to be this way because we haven't got time to do it any other way or because we've got other more pressing projects to work on. So it's a challenge managing all the creative people that are involved in it and all the different skill sets as well and different outlooks. But I think if you've got the right people and you give them the kind of empowerment they need to work on them, then it does pay dividends, certainly. One of the biggest challenges we have is content for our websites and for our other kind of interactive media, such as intranet and other things as well. The web is a very different medium from print. And although we have a lot of very good writers here who are used to writing technical documentation or press releases or whatever, they tend to be from a print background. The web is a new medium and it has very different requirements from any other medium that I know of. And I think it's only now starting to dawn on people that they do actually have to think differently. It's not just a question of writing fewer words, it's actually writing with the audience in mind and with the medium in mind. So it's thinking about, okay, we might want to give people more information here, but we can do that on a separate page. We can do it in a different format. We can use images to convey that idea rather than just having 1,000 words of text. And I think that is a challenge, and it's becoming more so as more people want to get involved with the web. We're getting to the point where we can't, as a central web team, we can't manage all the content on the site ourselves. So we have to kind of devolve out some of that responsibility. And that means giving people the ability to update the site themselves, to create new content, which brings in its own problems because not everyone can write, and particularly not everyone can write for the web. And content isn't just text either. I mean, there's selecting the right images to use, and that goes back to the kind of legal issues. People think they can just, any image they've got on their computer, they can put up on the website. Well, they can't. And you can get yourself into quite difficult legal issues if you start using things that you're not allowed to use. So there are a lot of challenges for us to kind of get across to people what are the ways in which you should convey information online, and also to think about the broader context. Even though people might be good at writing for the web and about their particular subject, they don't take into account the structure of the site as a whole and how that fits in with everything else they're trying to do so that we have a consistent online presence. So that's a challenge as well, and that's where we come in to kind of mitigate that by saying, look, yeah, you might want to write 10,000 pages on climate change, but actually it's got to fit in with the rest of our approach. We don't want it to look like we only work on that, and we've got to make sure it works for someone doing their school project as well as for someone who's, you know, a university professor.
That iProfessionals Industry Insight was a production from ATSF. You can find more on our website at atsf.co.uk/mim.